You know, if you're not careful, you can hear what I just read as the manifesto of a modern-day terrorist rather than the gospel of the Lord. But it is the gospel of the Lord. It's the good news of Jesus Christ, who is the man of love, and he is talking about love. He's talking about the possible results of love. But Jesus is talking about authentic love, not the romantic, sweet love of a Hollywood movie, the results of which are always inevitably the same. Everybody lives happily ever after. That's not necessarily the results of authentic love. Authentic love can bring division, can disturb peace between two people, can even lead you to walk through fire, metaphorically speaking. That's why in today's vernacular, it's called tough love. You have a friend or a relative whom you observe is beginning to abuse the consumption of alcohol. You got a couple of options. You can ignore it. Pour them another rum and coke during happy hour. Enjoy the drinking with them. And as a matter of fact, if you do that, nothing will happen between you and them. The relationship will remain intact. Peace will remain between the two of you. As a matter of fact, as you share their drinking sessions, your camaraderie may even increase as you watch them destroy their lives. You have a second option. You can speak the truth to them. That will be met with opposition. That will cause division. That will destroy the peace between the two of you. That may even destroy the relationship. Tough love. Because it might even save their life. That's what Jesus is talking about today. And as we talk about love, and Jesus, the man of love, the question that comes to mind is, what's so important about all this love anyway? Especially if it might result in what we heard today in the gospel. Why does God insist you be a person of love? Why does every New Testament writer talk about love? Love your neighbor. Love one another. If you love me, you will love the Father, and he will love you. What's so important? Why does God insist that you be a person of love? There was a young woman who attended an adult class of religious education at her parish. She was a quiet woman, pretty much kept to herself, and she liked it that way. She was a good student, but she very seldom participated in the class, preferring to let others ask all the questions. One evening, the priest instructor was talking about the evil of sin, what it might result in. And he was explaining, sin can destroy mortal life. Sin can poison the soul, weaken the soul, sicken the soul, and even lead to eternal condemnation. At this point, the young woman could not contain herself, so she raised her hand. She said, "Father, I hear what you're saying. I understand what sin can do. But," she said, "what is sin?" Because, she said, years ago, it seemed to me, in our church, the difference between what is sin and what is not sin were pretty clear. But today, she said, the lines seem to be more blurred, a little more ambiguous. For example, she said, "I knew that years ago, if we ate meat on Friday, that was a sin. If we missed Mass on Sunday, that's a sin. If people lived together without benefit of marriage, they were living in sin. But today," she said, "I know we can eat as much meat on Friday as we wish. All kinds of people live together without benefit of marriage, and I'm no longer certain if I'm still under a serious obligation to attend Mass on Sunday." So she concluded her question this way. She said, "Can you tell us what sin is, but not a theological definition, a theoretical definition, something simple, a definition we can live with in our everyday lives. The priest thought a moment, and then he answered her in words to this effect. He said, sometimes to understand sin, to understand any word, it is helpful to understand its etymological background. He said, the word sin comes down to us from the ancient Greeks who loved competitive sports. Now, one of those sports was archery, and the way the Greek competitors conducted their archery, the archer, of course, would stand at one end of the range, affix his arrow to the bowstring, pull it back, let it fly, and it would hit the target at the other end of the range. Next to the target, there stood a man who was known as the spotter, and he held in his hand a stick, and at the end of the stick was a large disc. When the arrow hit the target, he would remove the arrow and place the disc on the target where the arrow had struck, so the archer would know how close he came to the bullseye. If the arrow missed the target, then the spotter would raise his hand and cry out in a loud voice, sin, because the Greek word sin meant off the target. Now, apply that to your spiritual life. Do you know why you're here? You were created for only one thing, and one thing only, to love. You were created by love, for love, to love. There is no other reason for your existence on this planet. You are not here to feed the hungry. You are not put here to clothe the naked, to oppose abortion, to oppose the death penalty. The only reason that you exist is for you to love. Now make no mistake about it. If you love someone and you know they're hungry, you can't stand that, so you will feed them. If you love someone and you discover they haven't got sufficient clothing to protect themselves from the elements, you will clothe them. If you love the unborn, you'll protect them. If you love the condemned, you'll oppose the death penalty. But the only reason for your existence is for you to love. Now, when you're kind and considerate to your spouse, that's love. When you're impatient and short-tempered with your children, that's failure to love. When you put in a full day's work for that day's pay, that's love. When you cheat your employer, that's failure to love. When you cheat your employees, that's failure to love. But the only reason for you to exist is for you to love. Now then, a few years ago, I was reading a newspaper story about the fate of TWA Flight 800. Most of you remember that. It was a flight that took off from Kennedy International, and after a short while after takeoff, it inexplicably exploded in midair. And I don't think, even to today, the officials know what caused the explosion. They might know, I'm not sure, but be that as it may, as I read the story, I could not help but think about the fate of those poor people on that airplane. You all experienced an airplane ride. You know what it was like. The plane took off from Kennedy. It climbed to a predetermined altitude. It leveled off. And about that time, the attendant probably came over the public address system and said something like, the captain has turned off the seatbelt lights. Passengers may now feel free to wander about the cabin. When you are seated, for your convenience and safety, your seatbelt should remain fastened. Maybe the guy in front of you stands up and rustles through the overhead bin, perhaps to get a book. Maybe you turn to your seatmate and you say, now when we get to the airport, who's going to pick us up? Because the first thing I want to do, dead. In the flick of an eyelash, suddenly for you, the present moment becomes the experience of eternity. In the skip of a heartbeat, suddenly for you, the present moment finds you standing face to face with God. And before you is that one single burning issue in the face of which everything else will fade into irrelevance. Who will win the presidential election? Will I get that pay raise? Will I pass the test? All of that will fade into irrelevance in the face of that one single burning issue. Did you love? Did you love? Because to love is to hit the target, and to miss the target is to sin. Now, with a clear understanding of what sin is, That should bring to you a very clear understanding of why love in your life is so important. Why God insists you be a person of love. Because sin is failure to love. When love is absent in your life, that creates sin. And the presence of love destroys it.